Hitler's War by David Irving. The chapter is Eclipse. There are clues in the documents as to how long Hitler believed he could postpone the end. For example, he had ordered the general staff to provision the Berlin area with logistics sufficient to hold out for 20 days, should the city be surrounded. If open conflict had not broken out between Stalin and the Americans by then, Hitler realized his gamble had failed. It would be his Eclipse, to use the codename assigned by his victorious enemies to the post-war carve-up of the Reich. By April 15, 1945, the document outlining this plan, captured from the British in the West, was in his hands. Its maps revealed that Berlin was to be an enclave far inside the Russian occupation zone, divided like Germany itself into British, American, and Russian sectors. What encouraged Hitler, studying these maps, was the fact that the American spearheads, in reaching the Elbe, had already encroached on Stalin's zone, while the Russians had duly halted at their demarcation line on reaching St. Pölten in Austria late on April 15th. Foreign Armies East reported on the 15th that Russian officers were apprehensive that the Americans were preparing to attack. Quote, "We must drench the Americans accidentally with our artillery fire," Russians had said, "to let them taste the lash of the Red Army." End quote. Over and over during the next 2 weeks, Hitler restated the belief that sustained him. Quote, "Perhaps the others," meaning Britain and the United States, "can be convinced after all that there is only one man capable of halting the Bolshevik colossus, and that is me." End quote. This was the point of fighting an otherwise hopeless battle for Berlin. So far, the British had been blinded by their hatreds, but the Americans suddenly proved more amenable. On the night of April 17th, SS General Hermann Fegelein, Himmler's representative, informed Hitler that secret talks between SS General Karl Wolff and Alan Dulles in Switzerland had resulted in draft terms for a separate armistice on the Italian front. The enemy alliance could thereby be torn asunder. At 3 a.m., the Führer sent for Wolff and congratulated him. He asked the general not to leave Berlin until the next evening, to give him time to think it over. Quote, "I am grateful that you've succeeded in opening the first doorway to the West," he said. "Of course, the terms are very bad." End quote. But by 5 p.m., his mood had hardened again. Strolling with Wolff, Kaltenbrunner, and Fegelein in the Chancellery Garden, he enlarged on his own hopeful theories. Quote, "I want the front to hold for 8 more weeks. I am waiting for East and West to fall out. We are going to hold the Italian fortress at all costs, and Berlin too." End quote. Franz von Sonnleitner came to take leave of Hitler. Ribbentrop was sending him south to take care of the Italian gold. Hitler probably knew he would not see this Austrian party veteran again. For a while, standing in the Chancellery's bare first-floor salon with its sagging floor, they talked about Salzburg, Sonnleitner's hometown. The latter's mention of a stick of bombs had struck down the cathedral's dome was the signal for Hitler to take refuge in architectural nostalgia. The Americans, he said, were destroying Europe's great treasures because they had none of their own. He reflected on his own misplaced chivalry in sparing Rome by declaring it an open city in June 1944. He had inflicted more disadvantage on his own troops when he spared Florence's famed Ponte Vecchio, too. He had ordered the demolition of the casino at Ostend, he said, only with utter reluctance to meet the demands of the local coastal sector command. He sighed and consoled Sonnleitner, quote, "Never mind, Salzburg's cathedral will be rebuilt, and fast," end quote. Seeing the diplomat's incredulous expression, Hitler continued, quote, "Just think of the colossal capacity that will become available when we go over from wartime to peacetime production," end quote. They shook hands and parted. Hitler would not countenance the least vestige of defeatism. He had ordered the arrest of his former surgeon, Dr. Karl Brandt, for sending his wife and family to Bad Liebenstein, where they would fall into American hands. On April 18th, Brandt was summarily condemned to death. And there's an asterisk related to that. Brandt survived the war, only to be hanged by the Americans at Landsberg in 1947. Jeez. Entire armies could not be court-martialed for a losing heart. Zitzendorf fell to the Russians. On the 17th, Gauleiter August Eichgruber cabled from Linz that the, quote, petroleum fields are in jeopardy, unquote. But the next day, General Hans Krasing's 8th Army had already abandoned them precipitously after destroying the installations. Himmler reported to Hitler that in Austria, the army's tendency was to retreat everywhere, even though, quote, Ivan is obviously both wary and weary of fighting, end quote. This was Hitler's second motive for making a last stand in Berlin, to set an example to his generals and thereby restore his personal authority over them. Great slaughter had been inflicted on the Russians. On the 16th alone, Busse's 9th Army had destroyed 211 tanks and destroyed 106 more the next day. On the Oder front, General Fritz Graeser's adjacent 4th Panzer Army knocked out 93 and 140 tanks respectively on the Nysa front. Busse's front was still intact, but at Riesen in particular, the Russians had hammered a deep wedge into the main German line. Southeast of Berlin, Marshal Kunev's army group had thrown two bridgeheads across the Nysa on the very first day. In fact, just where Hitler had foreseen the Russian Schwerpunkt, though angled differently. Russian tanks were already approaching Cottbus and the Spree River at Spremberg. Kunev's objective, like Zhukov's, was obviously Berlin and not Prague. This gave Hitler rather less time than he had thought. On April 17th, Hitler ordered the Autobahn bridges blown up and every available aircraft, including the Messerschmitt jets, thrown in to stop the enemy reaching Cottbus. At his midday conference, he proclaimed, quote, "The Russians are in for the bloodiest defeat imaginable before they reach Berlin," end quote. After that, he sat brooding far into the night with Eva Braun and his secretaries, trying to convince them and himself that the wedge at Riesen was just the natural luck of the attacker. He began to blame General Heinrichi for the crisis on the Oder front, calling him, quote, "a plodding, irresolute pedant, lacking the necessary enthusiasm for the job," end quote. Everybody lacked enthusiasm compared to Hitler. During the 18th, a furious battle was fought for Silo, the high plateau commanding the Russian assault area. By evening, it was firmly in Zhukov's hands, and Hitler learned that the only SS Niederland division, a volunteer unit of Dutchmen, had been thrown into a counterattack. He erupted then, and he erupted again when he learned that Goebbels had sent 5 battalions of wholly unsuitable Berlin Volkssturm troops, quote-unquote troops, to the Oder front, although such troops were meant to be used only as a last resort in defense of their own towns and villages. There were enough able-bodied soldiers who could have been sent, if only they had had guns and ammunition. In an endeavor to halt the onset of his patient's Parkinsonism, the trembling limbs, Professor Morell had begun on the eve of the Soviet offensive to administer rapidly increasing doses of 2 exotic medicines. Quote, "As the tremor is a variety of a paralysis agitans," end quote. He had noted on April 15th, 1945, circumspectly using the Latin phrase, quote, "I am having a shot at influencing it temporarily by subcutaneous injections of Harman and administering Homburg 680, end quote. Both were chemicals extracted from deadly nightshade, indicated only for Parkinsonism. The next day, he gave another Harman injection and administered 1 drop of Homburg 680 in the evening. On the 17th, he tried 2 drops and observed a slight improvement. He decided to step up the dosage. Hitler's desk calendar, found in September 1945 in the ruins of the bunker, shows that Morell had left daily instructions for the anti-Parkinson medication to be steadily increased to 13 drops a day on the 28th, the final entry. From now until the end, Hitler slept only fitfully and irregularly. After the regular Harman injection on the 18th, the doctor recorded, quote, "tremor in the left hand somewhat improved, but drowsy. Sleeping at night now possible only with tempidorms," end quote. The days were punctuated by an unending series of ill tidings, each one bringing the end much closer than its predecessor. Restless and pallid, Hitler rambled around the shelter, took brief strolls upstairs, then sat in the in the telephone exchange or machine room, or visited his dogs in their makeshift kennels behind the lavatories. He took to sitting in the passageway with one of the puppies on his lap, silently staring at the officers passing by. The latest dispatch of Heinrich's army group on April 19th stated that at Münchberg, due east of Berlin, and at Riesen, farther north, the Russians had finally broken through into open country between 5 and 6 p.m. Immense tank forces were pouring through the two breaches. At Münchberg alone, tank killer squads and aircraft destroyed 60 Soviet tanks during the next few hours, while the Ninth Army's total that day was 22. Quote, "The battle," Heinrich's army group reported that evening, "is about to be decided," end quote. Hitler called for Dr. Morell, and at his behest, the physician crudely drained a quantity of blood from Hitler's right arm until it blocked the hypodermic needle, and Morell had to force a somewhat larger needle into the veins. Heinz Linge, the manservant, blanched as the blood ran into a beaker, but wisecracked, quote, "Mein Führer, all we need to do now is mix the blood with some fat and we could put it on sale as Führer blood sausage," end quote. Hitler repeated the unpleasant witticism to Eva and the secretaries that evening. Midnight would bring his 56th birthday. Bormann Wanley recorded that it was not exactly a birthday situation, unquote. Hitler had asked his staff to refrain from ceremony, but Eva Braun cajoled him into stepping into the anteroom and shaking hands with the adjutants. Sohr had brought a scale model of a 350 millimeter mortar for Hitler's collection. Hitler spoke for a while with Goebbels and Ley about his determination to defend the Alpine Redoubt and Bohemia Moravia in the south and Norway in the north. Then he retired to drink tea with Eva. All night after that, he lay awake until the knocking of Linge told him it was morning. General Bergdorf was outside the door. He shouted that during the night the Russians had broken through Schirner's army group on both sides of Spremberg. The 4th Panzer Army was trying to repair the breaches by a counterattack. Hitler merely said, quote, "Linge, I haven't slept yet. Wake me an hour later than usual at 2 p.m. End quote. When he awoke, Berlin was under heavy air attack. It was now April 20th, 1945. His eyes were stinging. Morell gave him a glucose injection. Then Hitler fondled a puppy for a while before lunching with Eva and the two duty secretaries, Johanna Wolf and Krista Schroeder. There was no conversation. After lunch, they all picked their way along the duckboards into the Voss bunker to steal another look at the model of Linz. He identified to them the house where he had spent his youth. Wrapped in a gray coat with its collar turned up, he climbed the spiral staircase to the Chancellery Garden, followed by Goebbels. The Berlin air was thick with the dust and smoke from 100 fires. A short line of fresh-faced Hitler youths awaited decoration for bravery. A photographer captured the scene as he walked along the line. The perimeter wall was punctuated by dugouts and piles of bazookas at the ready. Near the music room, a small parade of troops from the Courland battlefield awaited inspection. Hitler apologized for not being able to speak very loudly, but he did promise that victory would be theirs and that they could tell their children that they had been there when it was finally won. At about 4 p.m. that afternoon, he retraced his steps into the shelter, having seen the sky for the last time. Before the main war conference began, he allowed his principal ministers in one at a time to proffer formal birthday greetings. Field Marshal Keitel dropped a broad hint that it was time for the Führer to leave this city. But Hitler interrupted, quote, "Keitel, I know what I want. I'm going to fight in front of Berlin, fight in Berlin, and fight behind Berlin," end quote. The conference began immediately. Both north and south of Berlin, the Russian armored spearheads were hurtling westward. Unless Schirner's counterattack succeeded, the last main road south would be cut in a matter of hours. General Koller pointed out that the truckloads of OKW equipment and documents would have to leave Berlin for the south immediately. Hitler authorized an immediate splitting of the command. Dönitz and part of the OKW staff were to leave for northern Germany. Another part were to leave at once for the south. He gave the impression that he would in due course follow. Bormann left the room at once to organize sufficient armored transport and omnibuses for the transfer. Goering, whose own truckloads of property were already waiting for the word to go, inquired, quote, Mein Führer, do you have any objection to my leaving for Berchtesgaden now? End quote. Hitler frigidly granted Goering's plea. At 9:30 p.m., as a new air raid started, he sent for the two soldier secretaries Johanna Wolf and Christa Schroeder. The latter wrote a shorthand note on this a few days later. Quote, pale, tired, and listless. He met us in his tiny bunker study where he had eaten our meals or had tea with him of late, where we had eaten our meals. He said that the situation had changed for the worse over the last 4 days. Quote, I find myself compelled to split up my staff, and as you are the more senior, you go first. A car is leaving for the south in 1 hour. You can each take two suitcases. Martin Bormann will tell you the rest. End quote. I asked to stay in Berlin so that my younger colleague could go as her mother lived in Munich. He replied, quote, No, I'm going to start a resistance movement, and I'll need you two for that. End quote. He put out his hand to stop any further argument. He noticed how downcast we were and tried to console us. Quote, We'll see you soon. I'm coming down myself in a few days' time. Unquote. In the midst of our packing, the phone rang. I answered it. It was the chief. In a toneless voice, he said, quote, Girls, we're cut off. Your car won't get through now. You'll have to fly at dawn. End quote. But soon after he phoned again, quote, Girls, you have to hurry. The plane's leaving as soon as the all clear sounds. Unquote. His voice sounded melancholy and dull, and he stopped in mid-sentence. I said something, but although he still had not hung up, he made no reply. And end quote. Still more tanks were pouring through the big gap between the 4th Panzer and 9th Armies. Schirner's counterattack had begun, but when Hitler called on Heinrichi to attack in order to close the gap, the Army Group Commander demurred, demanding permission to pull back the 9th Army's right flank instead, as it seemed in danger of encirclement. As Heinrichi could give Hitler no assurances that this would not cost the flank corps its entire artillery, Hitler ordered the line held where it was. Heinrichi telephoned the general staff half an hour after midnight to protest that Hitler's order was, quote, unrealizable and hopeless, unquote. Quote, I ought to declare Mein Führer as the order against your interests. Wait a minute. I ought to declare Mein Führer as the order against your interest. I request you to relieve me of my command. Then I can go into battle as an ordinary Volkssturm man with a gun in my hand. Unquote and end quote. General Krebs dryly pointed out, quote, The Führer expects you to make a supreme effort to plug the gaps as far east as possible, using everything you can scrape together, regardless of Berlin's later defense. End quote. In fact, General Heinrichi had already decided to override Hitler's orders. The Ninth Army, he felt, should withdraw westward while it still could. Thus, the breach which must eventually seal Berlin's fate was further widened. But at the time, Hitler believed that his orders were being obeyed. That night, he finally resolved not to leave Berlin. Cramped in his study with his two remaining secretaries, Trottel Junge and Gerda Daranowski, he explained, quote, I must force the decision here in Berlin or go down fighting, unquote. Using the code name for Hitler, Bormann cabled to the Berghof, quote, Wolf is staying here because if anybody can master the situation here, it is only he, end quote. Hardly anybody arrived for the night conference. Krebs operations officer brought the grim news that the breach in the 4th Panzer Army had widened still farther. Hitler calmly blamed this on that army's quote-unquote betrayal. The officer challenged him, quote, Mein Führer, do you really believe so much has been betrayed? End quote. Hitler cast him a pitying look, quote, All our defeats in the east are solely the resort of treachery, end quote. At 1 a.m., he dismissed the two stenographers, Kurt Peschel and Hans Jonaschat, so that they too could catch the night's plane south. Ambassador Walter Huell stuck his head around the door, quote, Mein Führer, do you have any orders for me? End quote. Hitler shook his head. Ribbentrop's representative exclaimed, quote, Mein Führer, the 0 hour is about to strike. If you still plan to achieve anything by political means, it's high time now, end quote. Hitler replied with an exhausted air, quote, When I'm dead, you'll have more than enough politics to contend with, end quote. Outside, the all clear was just sounding. Admiral von Puttkamer was leaving. Karl Otto Sohr joined him on the plane, with orders to organize in the Alps, what arms production he could. About 80 other staff members flew south that night. The next morning, April 21st, there was a hammering on Hitler's bedroom door. Linge shouted that artillery had begun pouring shells into the heart of Berlin. Hitler telephoned orders to the OKL to identify and attack the Russian battery at once. General Koller assured him, quote, "The Russians have no railway bridges across the Oder. Perhaps they have captured and turned around one of our heavy batteries." End quote. Soon after, Koller came on the phone again. The offending Russian battery had been spotted from the observation post atop the towering anti-aircraft bunker at the zoo. It was just 8 miles away at Marzahn. Throughout the day, a growing sense of isolation seized Hitler's bunker. Nothing had been heard from General Helmuth Wiedling's 56th Panzer Corps, due east of the city, since the previous evening. According to one incredible report, Wiedling himself had fled with his staff to the Olympic Village west of Berlin. His arrest was ordered. The jets had been prevented by enemy fighter patrols from operating against the Russian spearhead south of Berlin. Hitler angrily phoned Koller, quote, "Then the jets are quite useless. The Luftwaffe is quite superfluous," end quote. Later, he again angrily called up Koller. "The entire Luftwaffe, quote, "the entire Luftwaffe command ought to be strung up," end quote. And he slammed the phone down. Heinrichi, ordered to report in person to the shelter that day, asked to be excused as he was, quote, "completely overburdened," unquote. He successfully avoided having to look his Führer in the eye ever again. During the afternoon, Hitler began planning his last attempt at plugging the breach torn in Heinrichi's front northeast of Berlin, an ad hoc battle group under the bullet-headed SS General Felix Steiner must push south during the night from Eberswalde to Werneuchen. If Steiner succeeded, Zhukov's advance forces north of Berlin would be cut off. Hitler's detailed order to Steiner, issued about 5 p.m., had a hysterical undertone. Quote, "Any officers failing to accept this order without reservations are to be arrested and shot at once. You will account with your life for the execution of this order," end quote. Krebs repeated this to the overbusy Heinrichi by telephone, but Heinrichi was also preoccupied with salvaging his right flank, the Ninth Army's flank corps from Russian encirclement and at Fürstenwalde. Russian encirclement at Fürstenwalde. Quote, "All I can manage now is to pull it back south of the string of lakes southeast of Berlin," end quote, Heinrichi warned. This was tantamount to abandoning Berlin. As for the Steiner attack, if the Führer insisted on it, then Heinrichi asked to be replaced as Steiner's superior. Hitler insisted, but did not replace him. He was running out of generals. At 9 p.m., he learned that a battalion of the quote-unquote Hermann Göring division was still defending the Reichsmarshal's abandoned forest palace, Carenhall. He ordered the force handed to Steiner, and when Koller plaintively telephoned at 10:30 p.m. to ask where Steiner was, the Führer snatched the phone from Krebs' hand and rasped, quote, "Any commander holding men back will have breathed his last breath within 5 hours. You yourself will pay with your life unless every last man is thrown in," end quote. Krebs confirmed this. Quote, "Everybody into the attack from Eberswalde to the south," and hung up. What orders Heinrichi now issued to Steiner, we do not know, but to attack Zhukov's flank with a motley collection of demoralized, ill-armed troops would be courting disaster. Steiner, therefore, did nothing. The SS general's inactivity was the last straw for Hitler. After Sepp Dietrich's fiasco in Hungary, in the narrow confines of his bunker, the Führer suffered an apparent nervous breakdown on April 22nd. Little now stood between central Berlin and seemingly inevitable defeat. The Russians were in Köpenick, an eastern suburb, and approaching Spandau. By evening, they might well be fighting in the government quarter itself. This was the military position, as Krebs finally secured Hitler's authorization for the garrison at Frankfurt on Oder to abandon that city to the enemy as well. The war conference on April 22nd began routinely at about 3 p.m. Hitler asked about the operation, which had obviously been foreground of his mind all night, Steiner's counterattack in the north. An SS authority assured him the attack had begun. Within the hour, however, General Koller came on the phone with the word that Steiner had not yet begun his attack. This betrayal and deceit by the SS, of all people, shook Hitler to the core. He straightened up and purpled. He suspected a fait accompli to force him to leave Berlin. His eyes bulged. Quote, "That's it," he shouted. "How am I supposed to direct the war in such circumstances? The war is lost, but if you gentlemen imagine I'll leave Berlin now, then you've got another thing coming. I'd sooner put a bullet in my brains," end quote. Hitler abruptly stalked out. Walter Huell telephoned Foreign Minister Ribbentrop in extreme agitation. Quote, the Führer's had a nervous breakdown. He's going to shoot himself, end quote. Hitler ordered a telephone call put through to Goebbels and dictated to him an announcement. Quote, "I have decided to stay to the end of the battle in Berlin," end quote. He ordered Goebbels to bring his family to the shelter. Schaub hobbled in. Quote, "Schaub, we must destroy all the documents here at once. Get some gasoline," end quote. They retired to his tiny bedroom. While Schaub opened the safe and stuffed its contents into a brown suitcase on the bed, Hitler took his lightweight pistol from his trouser pocket and exchanged it for the more lethal 7.65mm Walther PPK from the bedside table. From the upstairs safes, more suitcases were filled and then emptied into a crater in the garden. For a while, Hitler stood with Schaub, watching his papers consumed by the flames. Quote, "Riccolo once said, 'Give me five lines one man has penned,'" end quote, Hitler lamented afterward. Quote, "What I have lost, my dearest memories, but what's the point? Sooner or later you've got to get rid of all that stuff," end quote. Hitler's anguished staff realized that he intended to remain in Berlin and brave the coming storm. Goebbels, Bormann, and Jodl begged him to reconsider. Dönitz and Himmler telephoned. Keitel cornered Hitler alone, but was interrupted almost at once. Quote, "I know what you're going to say. It's going to take a real decision, a ganzer Entschluss. I've taken it already, and I'm going to defend Berlin to the bitter end. Either I restore my command here in the capital, assuming Wenck keeps the Americans off my back and throws them back over the Elbe, or I go down here in Berlin with my troops fighting for the symbol of the Reich," end quote. Jodl pointed out that if Hitler committed suicide in Berlin, the German army would be leaderless. Unmoved, Hitler called Martin Bormann in and ordered him, Keitel, and Jodl to fly to Berchtesgaden that night to continue the war with Goering as acting Führer. All three refused. Somebody objected that there was not one German soldier who would be willing to fight for the Reichsmarshal. Hitler retorted, quote, "There's not much fighting left to be done, and when it comes to negotiating, the Reichsmarshal will be better at that than I," end quote. It was nearly 5 p.m., and the Russians were now reported to have taken the Silesia station. Hitler's petrified staff clustered in the passageway, many of them expecting to hear pistol shots announcing that Hitler had abandoned them. In a private aside to Eva Braun, General Bergdorf put their chances at only 10%. Jodl now had a brainwave. He reminded Hitler of the demarcation line shown on the captured Eclipse maps and suggested that they should swing Wenck's 12th Army around from west to east to use it to relieve Berlin. Hitler shrugged, quote, "Do whatever you want," end quote. Perhaps, as Jodl argued, now the Allies would take his anti-Bolshevik intent seriously. Keitel announced that he would drive in person to give the necessary orders to Wenck that night. Hitler ordered a hearty meal prepared for the field marshal before he sent out. Hitler was not appalled at the prospect of imminent death. At an August 1944 war conference, he had told his generals that in death he looked for, quote, "a release from my sorrows and sleepless nights and from this nervous suffering. It takes only the fraction of a second, then one is cast free from all that and rests in eternal peace," end quote. Besides, as he told Field Marshal Schroner, his death might remove the last obstacle preventing the Allies from making common cause with Germany. If Model could find the courage to take his own life, so would he. He, Adolf Hitler, was no Paulus. He gruffly instructed Eva Braun and the two remaining secretaries to get changed and fly south. Eva took both his hands in hers. Quote, "But you know I am going to stay here with you," end quote. Hitler's eyes glistened, and he kissed her lightly on the lips. Frau Jungich chimed in, quote, "I'll stay too," unquote, and Frau Christian echoed her, quote, "I wish my generals were as brave as you," Hitler replied. Despite a telephone call from his liaison officer, Hermann Fegelein, Himmler, delays on Hermann Fegelein, Himmler, well, let me just read that over again. Despite a telephone call from his liaison officer, Hermann Fegelein, Himmler had failed to show up at the shelter, evidently fearing, from what Fegelein told him, that he would be arrested for SS General Steiner's passivity. Fegelein was sent to meet him halfway, but now failed to return. Hitler learned that Himmler had a battalion of 600 SS troops for his own safety outside Berlin. He invited Himmler through his personal doctor, Karl Gebhardt, to contribute them to the defense of the Chancellery. Sometime after, Himmler's chief lieutenant, General Gottlob Berger, arrived. Hitler repeated to him his reproaches about the SS's disloyalty and asked Berger to go to Bavaria to crush the dissident and separatist movements stirring there and in Württemberg and Austria. His last instruction to Berger before the latter flew south was to round up as many British and American officer prisoners as possible and transport them under guard to the Alpine Redoubt as hostages. Under cover of darkness, still more of his staff left Berlin. Pale and wheezing, Professor Morell offered Hitler a last injection before he left, a morphine pick-me-up, but Hitler suspected that a plot might be afoot to drug him and evacuate him from Berlin by force. Quote, "You can take off that uniform and go back to your practice in the Kurfürstendamm," end quote. Morell flew out that night. Hitler sent out the remaining two stenographers as well. Their orders were to take last shorthand records to the quote-unquote outside world. He now instructed his press officer, Heinz Lorenz, to take down the remaining war conferences. Lorenz's fragmentary shorthand notes, which begin with Keitel's exhausted return with Jodl from the battlefield at 3 p.m. on April 23rd, reveal the growing desperation at Hitler's shelter. Quote, "It is all so abominable. When you come to think it over, what's the point of living on?" unquote, exclaimed Hitler. Steiner had made no discernible move with his 25th Panzer Grenadier and 7th Panzer Divisions at Elberswalde, north of the capital. The Russians had swarmed across the Havel River between Oranienburg and Spandau. The situation on Germany's other fronts no longer occupied Hitler. The bunker conferences devolved only on the defenses of Berlin. Hitler's last stratagem began unfolding. At noon, Goebbels' ministry released the news. Quote, "The Führer is in Berlin. Our leadership has resolved to remain in Berlin and defend the Reich capital to the end," end quote. Lorenz recorded Hitler's belief thus, quote, "The enemy knows I am here. That gives us an excellent opportunity of luring them into an ambush. But this depends all on our people realizing the importance of this hour and genuinely obeying the orders they get from above. They must be honest about it. This business up here," indicating Steiner on the map, "was downright dishonest," end quote. General Krebs interjected, quote, "I believe we still have 4 days' time," end quote. Quote, "In 4 days we'll know the outcome," end quote, agreed Hitler. The quote-unquote ambush to which Hitler referred was the plan Keitel and Jodl had proposed, for Wenck's army on the Elbe and Mulde fronts to be turned around, to link up south of Berlin with Buss's 9th Army, and then strike northward towards Potsdam and Berlin, mopping up the elite Russian troops they thereby cut off. At the same time, the 41st Panzer Corps, commanded by the reliable General Rudolf Hulste, an old regimental comrade of Keitel's, would be brought back across the Elbe to counterattack between Spandau and Oranienburg. Steiner was to turn over his mechanized divisions, the 25th Panzer Grenadiers and the 7th Panzer, to Hulste. The realist in Hitler whispered that defeat was inevitable. Eva Braun wrote to her sister that April 23rd, quote, "The Führer himself has lost all hope of a happy ending," end quote. Later that day, however, she added, quote, "At present, things are said to be looking up. General Bergdorf, who gave us only a 10% chance yesterday, has raised the odds to 50-50 today. Perhaps things may turn out well after all," end quote. Hitler drank chocolate with Goebbels' children, who had now moved into Morell's quarters. Helmut read aloud his school essay on the Führer's birthday. Helga squawked, quote, "You stole that from Papa," unquote. Quote, "You mean Papa stole it from me," retorted Helmut, to the delight of the adult listeners. Before Keitel returned to Wenke's headquarters, he came in to see Hitler and quietly inquired whether any talks at all were proceeding with the enemy. Hitler replied that he must, quote-unquote, win one more victory. The battle for Berlin, that is. He disclosed that he had asked Ribbentrop to discuss further steps with him that evening. Ribbentrop's only proposal, however, was to have top Czech industrialists flown in that night to France, where they would attempt to persuade the Americans to protect Bohemia and Moravia from the Bolsheviks. Quote, "The Führer has agreed to this," Ribbentrop informed Karl Hermann Frank by letter. And end quote. For the first time, Hitler now admitted to Ribbentrop that the war was lost. He dictated to Ribbentrop 4 secret negotiation points to put to the British if he got the chance. If the continent was to survive in a world dominated by Bolshevism, then somehow London and Berlin must bury the hatchet. He instructed Ribbentrop to write secretly to Churchill in this sense. Quote, "You will see," Hitler predicted, "my spirit will rise from the grave, and one day people will see that I was right." End quote. When Ribbentrop left, an adjutant announced that Albert Speer had just made a venturesome landing by light plane on the east-west axis. Eva Braun, who, like Hitler, had been troubled by the recurring rumors of Speer's inexplicable behavior, greeted the ex-minister warmly. Quote, "I knew you'd return. You won't desert the Führer." End quote. Speer grinned. Quote, "I'm leaving Berlin again tonight." Unquote. Hitler asked his opinion on this decision, on his decision to fight the battle for Berlin to its end. The battle for Berlin to its end. Speer's brutal advice was that it was more seemly to die there than in his weekend cottage on the Obersalzberg. That is, if the Führer attached any importance to the verdict of history. Hitler, unaware that Speer had secretly arranged with General Heinrichi for Berlin to be abandoned, agreed. After the war conference, Bormann brought to Hitler a startling telegram just received from Goering at Berchtesgaden. Goering, it seemed, was seizing power. Quote, "Mein Führer," this began, "in view of your decision to remain in the fortress of Berlin, are you agreed that I immediately assume overall leadership of the Reich as your deputy in accordance with your decree of June 29, 1941, with complete freedom of action at home and abroad? Unless an answer is given by 10 p.m., I will assume that you have been deprived of your freedom of action. I shall then regard the conditions laid down by your decree as being met, and shall act in the best interests of the people and fatherland. You know my feelings for you in these hardest hours of my life. I cannot express them adequately. May God protect you and allow you to come here soon despite everything. Your loyal Hermann Goering." End quote. Ribbentrop had received from Goering a telegram asking the foreign minister to fly down and join him immediately. Keitel had also heard from Goering. Hitler immediately cabled Goering that he alone would decide when the decree of June 29, 1941 took effect. Goering was forbidden to undertake any steps in the direction he had hinted at. The Führer then ordered Goering placed under house arrest. Thus, with characteristic hesitancy, Hitler took the decision with which he had been grappling since September 1944, dismissing Goering. He telegraphed the Reichsmarshal, quote, "Your actions are punishable by death, but because of your valuable services in the past, I shall refrain from instituting proceedings if you will voluntarily relinquish your offices and titles. Otherwise, steps will have to be taken." End quote. This was not drastic enough for Martin Bormann, as the handwritten telegrams found 3 months later on his desk in the Bunker Ruins show. Quote, or not quote, asterisk. These were first published in this author's biography of the Reichsmarshal Goering, William Morrow Nerok, New York, and Macmillan, London, 1989. Acting apparently on Hitler's orders, Bormann cabled to SS Colonel Bernhard Frank, commander of the SS unit on the Obersalzberg, quote, "Surround the Goering villa at once and arrest the former Reichsmarshal Hermann Goering immediately, smashing all resistance," end quote. Bormann had other old scores to settle with Speer and Lammers, too. His next telegram to Frank read, quote, "You guarantee with your neck for the execution of the Führer's order. Find out where Speer is. Take Lammers into custody, honorable as yet. Act circumspectly, but like lightning. Bormann." End quote. And Bormann does not mess around. His own days might be numbered, but Bormann was in his own vicious element. To Gauleiter Paul Giesler of Munich, he cabled this instruction, quote, "Führer issued to SS unit on Oberg order for immediate arrest of Reichsmarshal Goering for plotting high treason. Smash any resistance. Occupy airfields at Salzburg, etc. immediately to prevent airplane flight." Bormann, unquote. At 10:25 p.m., he phoned Grand Admiral Donitz in northern Germany and told him the Führer had forbidden any elements of the Reich government to fly south to join Goering. Quote, "That's got to be prevented at all costs," end quote. There was uproar in the bunker about Goering's treachery, quote-unquote treachery. Before leaving it for the last time, Speer wrote to General Gallant, now a jet fighter squadron commander in Bavaria, quote, "The Führer has ordered Goering's arrest. I request you and your command and your comrades to do everything to prevent any aeroplane flight by Goering in the manner discussed," end quote. Thus Speer hoped, literally, to see his old enemy shot down at the 11th hour. But at 11:44 p.m., a telegram arrived from the Obersalzberg, cheating Speer of this little triumph. Quote, "Mein Führer," Frank reported, "beg to report Hermann Goering and co. arrested. No incidents so far. Details follow," end quote. Hitler ordered Colonel General Robert Ritter von Kreim to fly to Berlin to take over the Luftwaffe, but the general's takeoff from Munich was delayed by an air raid. On the following day, April 24th, Hitler subordinated the General Staff's Eastern Front to the OKW's Operations Staff. The horizons were drawing in on him. Soon he would be able to communicate with the outside world, only via a telephone line to the Admiralty's still-functioning signals room. Jodl's clear instructions to the armies were repeated by Hitler on April 24th. Generals Holste, Wenck, Schoner, and Busse were to speed up their relief attacks toward Berlin, from northwest, southwest, and south, respectively, and, quote, "restore a broad land contact with Berlin again, thereby bringing the Battle of Berlin to a victorious conclusion," end quote. But apart from Wenck and Schoner, Hitler's commanders were driven only by the compulsion to escape the Russian grasp themselves before the final collapse came. Apart from word that part of the Ninth Army had been encircled southeast of Berlin, there was no news of the army until Wiedling, the quote-unquote missing commander of its 56th Panzer Corps, reached Berlin's outskirts and the public telephone. He thereafter stormed into the chancellery, protesting his innocence of the charge of desertion. Hitler willingly appointed this fiery general battle commandant of Berlin. Wiedling's new task was nigh impossible. Hitler and Goebbels had optimistically sacrificed the capital's resources to the forward defenses on the Oder. A decamping army commandant had blown up Berlin's last major ammunition dump at Kramnitz. Wiedling would have hardly any tanks. Apart from the shattered remnants of his own corps, the coming street battles would be fought between trained, professional Russian combat troops with the glint of final victory in their eyes, and a few thousand German flak soldiers, Volkssturm men, and police units. About 2,700 youths had been mustered into a tank killer brigade. Hitler assigned his Hitler Youth offering to the defense of the bridges across which the armies must surely soon march into his relief. From Flensburg, Admiral Dönitz promised to airlift 2,000 of his best soldiers and fortress troops into Berlin in the next 48 hours, and to put 3,500 more of his most cherished fleet personnel, including crews trained to operate the new secret U-boat types, on standby for the fight. If Berlin did not win this last battle, those submarines would never operate. He kept his promise, unlike Himmler, who eventually parted with only half his personal security battalion. Even Ribbentrop courageously requested permission to take up arms in Berlin. Huell telegraphed him in Mecklenburg, quote, "The Führer appreciates your intentions, but has turned you down. Until the ring encircling Berlin has been broken open, or until you receive further instructions, you are to stand by outside the combat area," end quote. Huell added significantly, quote, "I have no political information whatever," unquote, disregarding Hitler's veto. Disregarding Hitler's veto, Ribbentrop asked a panzer unit to let him go with them on a combat patrol. This time, General Wiedling himself turned him down. Heinrich Himmler, too, was outside the closing Soviet ring. Bormann dictated to his secretary, Ilse Krüger, this previously unpublished situation report for the Reichsfuhrer. Quote, "My dear Heinrich, April 25th, 1945. My dear Heinrich, Fegelein mentioned on the phone you'd be coming in, but given the dangers involved, you should not fly in, but remain outside. The Führer emphasized how valuable and indispensable your work is. The Führer's main motives for remaining in Berlin are as follows. Besides, it would be right for the Reich government and Führer to, quote-unquote, pull back, to use that rotten word, just as lightheartedly and often as our army units do. If the leadership demands that the soldiers stand fast, then it too must know and toe a line which cannot be stepped over. In southern Germany, a government would have as little prospect of survival as in north. Even the much-vaunted last redoubt in the Tyrol would very rapidly cave in. The total collapse after the capitulation of Berlin in northern Germany would immediately overwhelm the eastern front, Schörner and Rindelich, too, and the German government would have to accept whatever peace terms it could get. The Führer could never do that, while no doubt a Goering could certainly accept such a peace. Now, to what Goering was planning... In the Führer's opinion, it had to be planned and prepared for some time. Before Goering drove off to the south on the afternoon of the 20th, he told Ambassador Huell he would have to negotiate now, without fail, at any price, and he was the only one who could do it. He, Goering, was not implicated in the Nazi Party's sins, the treatment of the church question, the concentration camps, etc., etc. Our enemies would obviously only be able to accept a man who was blameless, and had even... like Goering, condemned much of what was going on from the outset. The text of the invitation telegrams he sent out shows, in the Führer's view, very clearly enough, where Goering was heading. He issued an ultimatum to be given freedom to act both domestically and abroad. He had even arranged for a radio broadcast truck to stand by. Detailed investigations are still going on. Typically, the former Reichsmarshal has not lifted a finger to aid the battle for Berlin since his departure. He just set about preparing his treachery. In the opinion of the people here, anybody else in his position would immediately have done all he could to display his loyalty to the Führer by the most energetic actions. Not so for Goering. It's not hard to imagine what his radio broadcast would have sounded like. Apart from anything else, it would have brought about the immediate and total collapse of the Eastern Front, whom the Führer is going to appoint as successor will shortly be ascertained. At any rate, we're staying here and holding on as long as possible. If you can all relieve us in time, this will certainly be a decisive moment in the war, because the differences of opinion between our foes are becoming more acute with every day. I personally am convinced that the Führer has once more taken the right decision. Others are less convinced or prefer to offer their counsels from safe havens. The pressure to come to Berlin and see the Führer is at present at its lowest ebb. The compulsion to go somewhere else and to wait and see to the accompaniment of more or less authentic-sounding excuses is great. As for us, we'll keep our honor and loyalty as always. End quote. On that day, the Russians had encircled Berlin and linked up with the Americans on the Elbe, without incident. But Wenck's relief attack began making progress toward Potsdam at last, and Field Marshal Schörner, whose army group had just recaptured Bautzen and Wiesenberg south of Berlin, inflicting heavy losses on the Russians, also began moving northward toward the capital. Quote, the attack by Schörner's army group proves... Hitler's staff cabled to Dönitz on April 26th, that given the will, we are still capable of beating the enemy, even today. End quote. These distant victories glowed faintly through the thickening gloom of the communications breakdowns besetting Hitler's bunker. Quote, the British and the Americans along the Elbe are holding back, Hitler observed. If I can win through here and hang on to the capital, perhaps hope will spring in British and American hearts that our Nazi Germany will spring in British and American hearts that with our Nazi Germany they may after all have some chance against this entire danger. And the only man capable of this is me. Give me one victory here, however high the price, and then I'll regain the right to eliminate the dead weights who constantly obstruct. After that, I will work with the generals who have proved their worth. End quote. Later, he again digressed on this theme. Quote, first, I must set an example to everybody I blamed for retreating by not retreating myself. It is possible that I will die here, but then at least I shall have died an honorable death. End quote. The 1st Battalion of Dönitz's naval troops arrived. The makeshift hospital in the Voss bunker next to Hitler's bunker filled with casualties. The government corridor was under non-stop bombardment by artillery and bombers. Wiedling reported to Hitler that it was proving difficult to demolish bridges, for example along the Teltow Canal defense line, because Speer's staff had decamped with all the bridge plans. Speer had also fought against the dismantling of the bronze lampposts along the east-west axis to prepare an emergency landing strip. Speer had protested, quote, you seem to forget I am responsible for the reconstruction of Berlin, end quote. During April 26th, spirits soared as the news of Venk's army approaching army and Schorner's successes trickled in. That evening, General Grime limped into the shelter with a female admirer, Hannah Reich, having been shot in the leg as his plane made a crash landing on the boulevard. Hitler sat at his bedside, morosely describing Goering's quote-unquote ultimatum and the history of the Luftwaffe's failure. At 10 p.m., German radio broadcast Grime's promotion to Field Marshal, and his appointment as Goering's successor. Hitler ordered his new Luftwaffe commander to concentrate the Messerschmitt jet squadrons around Prague. At night, he was kept awake by the shell fire and by his own vivid memories. This was Stalingrad all over again, but this time the miracle would happen. Quote, imagine, like wildfire, the word spreads throughout Berlin. One of our armies has broken through from the west and restored contact with us. Unquote. How could Stalin hope to reduce a great city of 4 million people with only 400 tanks, especially if 50 were being knocked out each day? Quote, the Russians have already exhausted their strength in crossing the Oder, particularly the Northern Army Group, Zhukov's. Unquote. According to Keitel, General Holste's battle group in the Northwest, had gained ground at Nauen and Kremmen. Hitler impatiently told Krebs, quote, it's high time they got a move on, end quote. General Wenck's relief offensive from the southwest had already reached the Schwilo Lake, and during the morning that party announced that it had reached Potsdam, thus attaining the tactical objective laid down 4 days before. At 5 a.m. on April 27th, a big Russian push along the Hohenzollern Dam Boulevard began. As Goebbels nervously put it, quote, I keep getting this nightmare picture. Wenck is at Potsdam, and here the Russians are pouring into Potsdamer Platz. Unquote. Quote, and I'm here at Potsdamer Platz, not Potsdam. Unquote. Oops, there was something I skipped over. Oh, the next quote was, I'm here at Potsdamer Platz, not Potsdam. That's Hitler agreeing uneasily. Okay. His eyes were transfixed by the color arrows marking the relief armies on the map. Late on the 26th, he had radioed Jodl, quote, make it clear to 9th Army that it is to wheel sharply north to the 12th Army to take weight off the battle for Berlin, end quote. General Busse's 9th Army encircled southeast of Berlin, had the tanks, but its westward movement seemed designed to bypass Berlin to the south. Hitler was puzzled by this defiance of his orders. There's an asterisk. Busse had decided to drive with his army remnants toward the American lines. Worthless. Anyways, back up. Throughout the 27th, he speculated on this puzzle. Quote, I just don't understand the direction of its attack. Busse's driving into a complete vacuum. Unquote. Late that day, it occurred to him that, at last, why the 9th Army had pleaded its radio failure. Quote, if there's a long radio silence, it is always the sign that things are going badly. Unquote. Quote, it's impossible to command if every plan that's drawn up is adapted by every army commander as he sees fit, unquote. North of Berlin, the general's disobedience to orders was even more blatant. Heinrich's remaining Oder sector had collapsed under the weight of Marshal Rokossovsky's attack. Got it. Since noon on April 26th, Heinrich had begged Jodl to allow General Steiner's two armored divisions to repair the damage. Heinrich assured Keitel he was holding a line from Angermunte to Ockerheim, but when the field marshal set out to the battlefield, he found the frontline troops in the midst of a well-prepared retreat. Keitel telephoned Hitler about Heinrich's deceit. Far from holding the line, Heinrich and Manteuffel, commanding the 3rd Panzer Army on the breached Oder sector, were deliberately herding their troops across Mecklenburg toward the haven of the Allied lines. At about 5 p.m., Jodl radio telephoned his grim decision to Hitler. Steiner's two armored divisions would have to be thrown northward, away from Berlin, into the Russian spearheads pursuing Manteuffel's troops. The hysterical atmosphere created by Jodl's radio telephone message can be judged from the words Martin Bormann jotted in his diary. Quote, the divisions marching to relieve us have been halted by Himmler and Jodl. We shall stand by and die with our Führer, loyal unto death. If others think they must act out of superior judgment, then they are sacrificing the Führer and their loyalty. Devil take them is no better than their... And their loyalty, devil take them, is no better than their sense of honor. End quote. In his sprawling handwriting, he also penned these hysterical lines about Heinrich Himmler. Quote, "One might have expected that H.H., at least once he received my letter of April 25th, would have addressed a fiery appeal to his SS, quote, SS men, our honor, a fiery appeal to his SS. Quote, SS men, our honor is our loyalty, unquote, the motto of the SS. But H.H. kept silent, while old Father Keitel drove around out there, raging and roaring, to raise help for us in time. H.H. tucked himself away at Hohenleiken, Dr. Gerbert's clinic, and Steiner's SS force, which was supposed to move off first, just marched on the spot from the word go. It just play-acted, and this was the force that H.H. should have appealed to first and foremost. Quote, SS men, rally to your Führer, for our battle flag, fluttering high ahead, let's keep the oath we all swore, our loyalty is our honor, unquote. No, H.H. just kept quiet. How are we supposed to interpret that? And what are we to make of the question he radioed to General Bergdorf, whether the Führer might not be judging Goering's intentions too harshly, unquote. Bormann's note continued. Quote, obviously H.H. is wholly out of touch with the situation. If the Führer dies, how does he plan to survive? Again and again, as the hours tick past, the Führer stresses how tired he is of living now with all the treachery he has had to endure. Were one to ignore the heroism of even the women and children, one can only agree with the Führer. How many disappointments this man has had to suffer until the very end. End quote. A premature dusk had fallen over Berlin above the bunker. As smoke and dusk blotted out the sun, camouflaged by swastika pennants, four Soviet tanks had even reached Wilhelmsplatz before they were detected and destroyed. Quote, identification regulations are to be strictly obeyed, Hitler ordered, unquote. The Russians announced that they were bringing up 370mm and 406mm mortars. Hitler handed his adjutants brass-encased cyanide capsules to use if absolutely necessary. When the time came, he would order a general breakout toward Wenck's army at Potsdam. He disclosed privately to Colonel von Below, quote, only my wife and I will stay behind, unquote. He contrasted Eva Braun's fidelity with the gross disloyalty displayed by Goering and Himmler, whom he intuitively blamed for Steiner's disobedience. At the late-night conference, General Krebs assured Hitler that the battle lines in Berlin itself were stable again. Hitler youths were holding a bridgehead south of the Pickelsdorf Bridge in anticipation of Wenck's arrival. Isolated trucks from Wenck's army had already broken through. The first Russian snipers were, however, roaming Potsdamer Platz. Hitler pointed out, quote, the subway and streetcar tunnels are a source of danger, unquote. A ticking clock coming over the loudspeakers warned that enemy bombers were still over Germany. Hitler could hear the distant singing of the Goebbels children in sixfold chorus as they prepared for bed. During the evening, he had unpinned his own Golden Party medallion and bestowed it upon their red-eyed mother, Magda. She wrote, quote, the thudding of shells is getting even on my nerves, but the little ones soothe their younger sisters, and their presence here is a boon to us because now and again they manage to prize a smile from the Führer, unquote. They told, quote, Uncle Hitler, unquote, that they were longing for the day when the new soldiers he had promised would come and drive the Russians away. For their sake, Hitler hoped too, though he himself had long decided to stay. Quote, in this city I have had the right to command others. Now I must heed the commands of fate. Even if I could save myself here, I will not do so. The captain, too, goes down with his ship. Unquote. At 3 a.m., it was now April 28th, Krebs telephoned Keitel at OKW's field headquarters. Quote, the Führer is most anxious to know about the relief attack west of Oranienburg. What's the news? Is it making any headway? The Führer doesn't want Steiner to be commander there. Hasn't Holste taken over there yet? If help doesn't reach us in the next 36 or 48 hours, it'll be too late, unquote. Keitel replied that he was going to see Steiner in person. It is unlikely that Hitler slept much that night. The Chancellery was under direct and heavy shell fire. He restlessly paced the bunker passageways, gripping a Berlin street map that was disintegrating in his clammy hands. Busse's 9th Army had last linked up with General Wenck's 12th, but both were beyond the limits of exhaustion. Moreover, by 4:30 p.m., General Krebs had learned from Jodl the full extent of Heinrich's disobedience north of Berlin. The southern flank of Manteuffel's 3rd Panzer Army was retreating across the Schorf Heath. Steiner was covering this illicit retreat and doing nothing to seal off the breach at Prenzlau. Keitel was apoplectic with anger and instructed Heinrich and Manteuffel to meet him at a lonely crossroads to account for their actions. One thing was certain. Berlin's northern defenses were wide open. This was not the only treason. Hitler had hardly seen Himmler's SS General Fegelein during this last week. Then, on April 28th, his staff began receiving erratic calls from Fegelein. Hitler suspected he was absconding, and he debated with Grimm the possibility that the Reichsfuhrer SS was condoning this, which might have sinister implications. Late that afternoon, Bormann showed him a stunning news report. Allied radio had proclaimed that Himmler had contacted the United States and Britain and guaranteed them Germany's unconditional surrender. Bormann sneered, quote, "I always said loyalty has to be stamped on your heart and not on your belt buckle," unquote. Fegelein's personal effects were searched and papers relating to Himmler's treachery were found, along with two money belts of gold sovereigns and other enemy currencies. Eva Braun, whose sister had married the SS officer, mournfully noted, quote, "The Führer is spared nothing," unquote. Fegelein's adjutant stated that he had last seen him changing into civilian clothes at his Kurfürstendamm apartment. Bormann cabled to his party headquarters in Munich at 8 p.m. Quote, "Instead of spurring on the troops to fight us free with orders and appeals, just silence from the top men, loyalty apparently yielding to disloyalty. We remain here, Reich Chancellery already in ruins," unquote. 2 hours later, General Wedling reported that the Russians were hammering Wenck's relief army into the ground. The situation in the city was desperate. Food and medical stores were exhausted. Wedling outlined his plan for a mass breakout. Hitler replied that he would not himself leave the Chancellery. His naval liaison admiral radioed to Dönitz, quote, "We are holding on to the very end," unquote. At midnight, Keitel's telegram arrived. At the crossroads rendezvous, Heinrich had suavely promised to obey orders, but at 11:30 p.m. he admitted he had in fact ordered a further retreat. Keitel had dismissed him. At about the same time, Eva Braun was phoned by Fegelein. Quote, "Eva, you must abandon the Führer if you can't persuade him to leave Berlin. Don't be stupid. It's a matter of life and death now," unquote. Within the hour, Fegelein had been found and brought back to the bunker, still in civilian clothes. Hitler told Bormann to hand him over to SS General Wilhelm Mahnke to help fight for central Berlin. But Bormann and Gutsche pointed out that Fegelein would just run away again. The Führer thereupon ordered him summarily court-martialed and executed. Quote, "Our Reich Chancellery is reduced to rubble," wrote Bormann in his diary. "On dagger's edge, the world now stands," unquote. Treason and treachery he's making a quote within his quote. So, "On dagger's edge, the world now stands. Treason and treachery," unquote. "Treason and treachery by Himmler and unconditional surrender announced abroad," end quote. There we go. You guys can look in the book yourselves to make more sense of that. Hitler saw this as the origin of Steiner's failure, too. Perhaps at this very moment, Himmler was plotting to kill or kidnap him. Suddenly, he mistrusted the cyanide capsules supplied by Morell's replacement, the SS surgeon Dr. Stumpfeger. He sent for the professor Werner Hasse from the Voss bunker operating theater and ordered him to test a sample capsule on Blondie, the largest animal available in the shelter. The dog's jaws were forced open and an ampoule was crunched inside them with pliers. The dog howled briefly and then stiffened. Hitler handed out ampoules to the rest of his staff, apologizing for being unable to offer them no kinder farewell gift. More Russian tanks were reported massing south of Potsdamer Platz for the assault on the Chancellery. While Eva Braun, Goebbels, and Huell hastily wrote last letters to their relatives, a chalk-faced Hitler slumped on Field Marshal Grimm's bed. Quote, "Our only hope is Wenck. We must throw in every plane we've got to cover his breakthrough," unquote. An Arado training plane had just made a brilliant landing on the shell-cratered Axis. Hitler ordered the injured Grimm to betake himself to Recklin Air Base to command the Luftwaffe attack and to arrest Himmler. Bormann and Krebs signed a joint appeal to General Wenck to break through as soon as he could, so as to furnish Hitler with a basis for political maneuver. But Hitler himself was already writing Finis. Himmler's treachery and the failure of the relief divisions left him with no desire to live on. With the concrete membranes reverberating under the blast of Russian shells, he sent for his youngest secretary, the widowed Trottel Junge, For a while, he stood at his usual mid-table place, leaning on the now bare mapped, or leaning on the now bare map room table with both hands and staring at her short pad. Suddenly, he barked out, quote, "My political testament," and began dictating it without notes, part pisse justificative, part pain of praise for his brave troops. There's an unquote there, but I don't know what I was quoting to begin with, because it doesn't... There's no beginning quote, whatever. Accomplishments. Quote, "From the sacrifice of our soldiers and my own leadership with them unto death, we have sown a seed which one day in Germany's history will blossom forth into a glorious rebirth of the National Socialist Movement, and thus bring about a truly united nation," end quote. Even dictated under stress and without notes, the document betrayed, at least in its drafting and construction, no trace of any mental disequilibrium. Hitler formally expelled Goering and Himmler from the party and appointed Dönitz as his own successor. Speer was also sacked. Field Marshal Schirner, quote, "the only man to shine as a real warlord on the entire Eastern Front," unquote, Hitler had sighed a day before, was appointed commander-in-chief of the German army. It was about 2 a.m., April 29th, 1945. Another notable event lay ahead. And this was at the forefront of Hitler's private testament, the document which he now dictated. Quote, "During my years of struggle, I believed I ought not to engage in marriage, but now my mortal span is at its end. I have resolved to take as my wife the woman who came to this city when it was already virtually under siege, after long years of true friendship, to link her fate with my own. It is her wish to go with me to her death as my wife. This will make up for all I could not give her because of my work on behalf of my people," unquote. Hitler bequeathed his effects to the party, or, if it no longer existed, to the state. With a neat realism, he added that should the state also have been destroyed, quote, "further dispositions on my part would seem superfluous," unquote. Elsewhere in the shelter, a small wedding party had assembled. A city official had been fetched from Goebbels' ministry as registrar, a slight, quiet-spoken man in party uniform and a Volkssturm armband. From time to time during the funereal wedding supper, Hitler left to discuss with Goebbels and Bormann the constitution of the cabinet with which Dönitz must carry forward the war against, quote, "the poisoner of all nations' international Jewry," end quote. Goebbels was included as Reich Chancellor, but Goebbels warned Hitler that he would not leave Berlin. Most of the rest were, quote, "moderates," unquote, like Seyss Inquart, Schwerin, von Krosigk, and Backe. Gauleiter Karl Hanke, still defending his embattled Breslau, was to replace Himmler as Reichsführer SS and Chief of Police. Bormann, the new party minister, was still transmitting strident messages to Dönitz at Flensburg. Quote, Foreign press reports treason. The Führer expects you to strike like lightning and tough as steel against every traitor in the North Zone. Without fear or favor, Schirner, Wenck, and rest must prove their loyalty to the Führer by fastest relief of Führer. Bormann, unquote. By 4 a.m., Frau Junge had finished typing the testaments in triplicate. Her chief wanted to make certain that one copy reached the outside world. Hitler himself was still reminiscing softly with Goebbels about the exhilarating struggle for power and empire which was now approaching its end. Their conferences over the next 36 hours were irregular and brief, for an information blackout of Stygian darkness was descending. His armies were silent, and for days he had seen no diplomatic cables. The progress of the fighting in Berlin could be followed only by ringing up telephone numbers at random. Often Russian voices answered. At noon on April 29th, Jodl reported briefly that Wenck was at a standstill. And then at 12:50 p.m., the OKW's VHF radio channel went dead. From now on, the enemy news bulletins were Hitler's main source of information on his own armies. Italian radio was monitored, describing the ugly scene as the bullet-riddled corpses of Mussolini, his mistress Clara Petacchi, and a dozen fascist leaders were strung up, quote-unquote, by their feet. Hitler mechanically underlined the words in pencil in a Milan square. Admiral Voss signaled from the shelter to Donitz at 4 p.m., quote, "All contact with army authorities outside cut off. Urgently request information on fighting outside Berlin via naval signals channel," unquote. Krebs aide Captain Gerhard Bolt suggested that he and two fellow officers attempt to contact the 12th Army. Hitler willingly dispatched them. Quote, "My regards to Wenck and tell him to hurry or it'll be too late," unquote. The three sets of testaments were entrusted to three other hardy souls who were ordered to smuggle them out to Donitz, Schirner, and the Obersalzberg. Bergdorf wrote to Schirner, quote, "The testament is to be published as soon as the Führer so orders, or his death is confirmed," unquote. Heavy fighting was going on at the Anhalt railroad station. With the tattered street map in his hand, Hitler spoke to his chauffeur, Erich Kempe, who had driven him on so many historic journeys since 1933. Kempe told him his motor pool was ferrying supplies to the troops guarding the chancellery, along a perimeter from the Brandenburg Gate to Potsdamer Platz. Quote, "Their courage is exceptional. They're waiting for General Wenck's relief columns to arrive," unquote. Hitler calmly responded, quote, "We're all waiting for Wenck," unquote. In his study, he wrote a last letter to Keitel. The fight would soon end, and he would commit suicide. Keitel was to support Admiral Donitz to the end. Quote, "Many people have abused my trust in them. Disloyalty and betrayal have undermined our resistance throughout this war. This was why it was not granted to me to lead my people to victory," end quote. He refused to believe that such great sacrifice could have been in vain. Quote, "The aim must still be to win territory in the east for the German people," end quote. The Russians were pushing down Saarlandstrasse and Wilhelmstrasse, and they were nearly at the Air Ministry. At 7:52 p.m., Hitler signaled five urgent questions to Jodl. Quote, 1. Where are my Wenck's spearheads? 2. When do they attack? 3. Where is the 9th Army? 4. In which direction is the 9th Army breaking through? 5. Where are Holste's spearheads? End quote. Around the same time, Bormann issued two signals. The first reflected the ugly atmosphere of the bunker and read, quote, "Our own impression is increasingly clear that for many days the divisions in Berlin battle zone have been marking time instead of hacking away out for the Führer. We only receive information supervised, suppressed, or doctored by Teilhaus," Keitel. "We can only transmit via Teilhaus. Führer orders you to take rapid and ruthless action against all traitors," unquote. The second signal was briefer. Quote, "The Führer is alive and directing defense in Berlin," end quote. At the last battle conference, on the 29th, General Wiedling announced that there was heavy fighting at the nearby Potsdam station. There were no bazookas left. A long silence followed this. Hitler warily lifted himself up from his chair and turned to go. Wiedling asked what his troops should do when their ammunition ran out. Hitler replied, quote, "Your men will have to break out in small groups," unquote. He restated this in a message to Wiedling and Moncke during the night. Soon after, he received Keitel's telegram replying to his four questions. It left no hope whatever that Berlin would be relieved. Quote, 1. Wenck's spearhead is stalled south of Schwielow Lake. 2. 12th Army is therefore unable to continue attack to Berlin. 3. Bulk of 9th Army encircled. 4. Holste's groups forced onto defensive. End quote. At Eva's suggestion, all the women in the Chancellery shelters were refugees fleeing from the Russians, nurses from the Voss bunker hospitals, cooks and officers' wives, were brought to one of the passages. His eyes bleary and unseeing, Hitler went and shook hands with them and spoke a few words in a low voice to each. One of the nurses began a hysterical speech, insisting that the Führer would bring them victory after all, but Hitler brusquely silenced her, quote, "One must accept one's fate like a man," end quote. He had taken a deliberate gamble by staying in Berlin. He knew it, and his gamble had failed. By morning on April 30th, 1945, he had decided to die at 3 p.m. He shaved and dressed as punctiliously as ever, donning the olive-green shirt, black shoes, socks, and trousers for the last time. He sent for Bormann and then for Otto Gunsche. He told them that he and his wife would commit suicide that afternoon. Guntur was to ensure that both were really dead by delivering coup de grace if necessary, and then burn both the bodies to ashes. Quote, I would not want my body put on display in some waxworks in the future. End quote. His bunker was to remain intact. Quote, I want the Russians to realize that I stayed here to the very last moment. End quote. Magda Goebbels sank to her knees and pleaded with him to stay, but he gently raised her and explained that his death was necessary to remove the last obstacle in Dönitz's path, if Germany was to be saved. His female staff was assembled, and a last lunch was taken together. When he walked through the bunker for the last time to say farewell, accompanied by Eva, he probably noticed a handful of officers of his escort waiting with two stretchers near the exit staircase. It was about 3:30 when Hitler and Eva withdrew into the little green-and-white tiled study. He closed the double doors, sealing out all sounds but the murmur of the ventilation plant and the echoing explosion of shells. Eva sat on the narrow couch, kicked off her shoes, and swung her legs up onto the faded blue-and-white upholstery beside her. Hitler sat next to her, with his mother's photograph to his right and the portrait of Friedrich the Great frowning down upon him. They unscrewed the brass casings and extracted the thin glass phials with their amber liquid content. Eva sank her head on his shoulder and bit the glass. Her knees drew up sharply in agony. Controlling his trembling hand with difficulty, Adolf Hitler raised the 7.65 millimeter Walther PPK to his right temple, clenched his teeth on the phial in his mouth, and squeezed the trigger.